this message is peer pressure proof, or how to be peer pressure proof. They conducted an experiment about peer pressure and had some unbelievable results. You might ask, you, what would you do if you were in a room, waiting room, and all of a sudden smoke came billowing in through the vent? Normally, you'd rush out of the room and tell somebody the building's on fire. Well, they say before you answer that question, you should ask, what's the influence of peer pressure? Astoundingly, the research found it's a question of who's in the room with you that affects your response. They set up three different groups, but in one group, a person was in the room by himself, who was the subject of the experiment. The smoke comes in. They rush out of the room, and 75% of them report to someone the building's on fire. But if they come in that room, and there are three people in the room, and the other two are confederates of the experiment, and they're not going to move, the person who's the subject of the experiment, only one out of ten did what was in their best interest, get out of there. They said, well, if they're not moving, why should I run? And only a small percentage of those who left even reported the fire. only 10% of the persons left the room. Isn't that amazing? And remember, if you see smoke coming out of a vent, and it was real smoke, although the building wasn't on fire, of course, it was an experiment, it's in your best interest to get out of that building and report a fire. But if other people are with you and they're not going to leave, the peer pressure is such that only one in ten would leave. Now, that shows you the power of peer pressure, because smoke is a clear danger. And then when you think of theology, which is a lot less clear than smoke, you see the power of peer pressure. So we're going to talk today about how to overcome it. And to some extent, this message hopefully will be helpful to young adults, because I think young adults face the greatest peer pressure. I know everybody faces some, but I think young adults face the greatest peer pressure. When you're older, you don't care as much because, well, we'll see. But you know what, hopefully you know what I mean. First of all, let's look at our goal. Our goal as Christians is to be ready to help the Messiah turn this world into a paradise. Because when Christ first comes back, except for those of us in the first resurrection, everybody else on the earth will still be physical, and they'll remain that way through the next resurrection and to the last great white throne, and you know, and then they'll be brought in gradually. But the point is, at least at the beginning, there'll be millions of human beings. Now, the great armies of the world will be smashed, so that'll be a good thing. People will be a little more humble. But still, this world is an absolute disaster. There are so many bad things going on in the world. And I know living in a nice place like Southern Illinois, you don't see the worst of the world. So you might kind of think, well, it's really not so bad. But remember, America is enjoying some of the blessings of Abraham, etc. But if you look at the world as a whole, it's an absolute mess. And we'll have lesser positions in Christ and the 12 apostles and all that. But even still, we'll be there help turn this world into a paradise. Let's go to Revelation 2:26. The reason I'm mentioning all of this is because if we don't learn how to hold up under peer pressure, we might lose our opportunity and not be there to help turn this world into a paradise. We're going to start Revelation 2:26. Revelation chapter 2, verse 26. And he that overcometh, and I'm going to say, obviously you have to overcome human nature, you have to overcome the evil society, but doesn't that mean also overcoming peer pressure? Because that's how the devil gets people to do a lot of bad things. Everybody else is doing it, so you're pressured to do it too. So we got to overcome a number of things, but peer pressure is one. He that overcometh, and keep my works unto the end. To those that say, there's absolutely nothing you have to do, there's so many scriptures in the Bible that knock that ball out of the ballpark. You know, what can you say? Almost in every book, keep my works in the end. To him will I give power over the nations. And power over the nations means real power. Maybe you'll be put in, I'll be in charge of Jamaica. And anyway, but you'll have power. And he shall rule them with a rod of iron. Not in cruelty, but I mean, it's going to be God's way, period. You know, it's not going to be, well, we think we want to do a little bit of that and this. And, you know, no, it will be God's way, the true religion. Rule them with a rod of iron. And won't be having elections every year so politicians can pontificate and take positions and then, you know, pretend. No, it won't be any of that. It'll be the right people in charge. I'm sure it'll be done in an orderly way and, you know, with various spirit beings and then the elders and, you know, and on down through the family structure. But he shall rule them with a rod of iron. As vessels of potter shall they be broken into shivers. In other words, God is going to break the governments and the systems of this world and replace them with the correct things. Just going up a couple pages to Revelation 5, 10. And this is when Christ comes back, of course. And he's made us unto our God kings and priests. And we shall reign. You know, that means you're going to run things. Reign on the earth. Not in heaven shuffling harps music, but it says on the earth. Right there in verse 10. That's where we're going to reign. Let's go to Revelation 3:11. By the way, the motto of our church, if you look at the little motto on the plaque here, is Revelation 3:11. Revelation 3:11 says, "Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast." That means hold on that you don't lose out. "Hold fast which you have, that no man take your crown." Well, how can a man take your crown? Probably two basic ways. One is, he could be a spiritual wolf and deceive you. And we'll talk about that at other times. But he can take your crown, maybe meaning, well-meaning, he just puts peer pressure on you and he sucks you back into the world. He doesn't mean it maliciously. He's just, you know, he doesn't know. And you can lose your crown because of peer pressure to conform to the rest of society. Why do you have to be different? I'm sure you've heard that from some of your relatives, right? You understand that expression. Let's go to Matthew 5. There's a very interesting verse here in Matthew 5 that I want to put in this context of peer pressure. Matthew 5:34. by the way, we know that one of God's laws is... hold on a minute. Ah, I must have made a mistake. What did I do wrong? That's really embarrassing. It's the scripture where Christ tells everybody is talking about. Christ says, basically, you have to love me more than you love your parents and anybody else that may pull you back into the world. And he says, you know, you have to love me more than father or mother. And I'm not sure. Anyway, I'll find it. We'll find it for you later. But the point of that verse is that when Christ says you have to love me more than father or mother, what he's saying is not that he's undermining the fifth commandment to honor your parents, but what he's saying is you have to love God first and foremost, even above your parents or your children or your grandparents or your siblings, over relatives. And that's not easy to do. It's not easy to do that. It's easy to say it. It's just not easy to do it. And I think it's one of those things that we often, have a real battle with. And so what I'm recommending today is three recommendations for overcoming peer pressure. One is to ask Christ for help. Stay close to Christ, because we're going to need him. For any overcoming, you're going to need Christ. Stay close to Christ. Number two, stay close to church members, because you can get positive peer pressure. Peer pressure can work in the other way, too. Positive peer pressure. You know, find the stronger people in the church who are going to stay the course and feel the influence of the positive peer pressure. And number three, one that I thought about, I think that God has chosen us because God believes he knows that we can resist peer pressure. There are probably some people God would not call in this first dispensation because they could never resist the peer pressure. And God doesn't want anybody to lose their salvation. They'll get an opportunity later. They'll miss a chance to be at the upper echelon of God's family, but they'll still get a chance. God saw something in each one of us. I believe if you're here in this room, God's called you. You may not believe it, but if you're in this room, I believe God has called you. And he sees something in you that's useful and that you can resist peer pressure. Now, obviously, we know from 1 Corinthians 1, God did not call the great or the mighty, because Paul says, you know, not many of the great or the mighty are called. So he didn't call us because we're better than other people. I don't mean that. And I know why God doesn't call the best people. Because if he called the best people, they'd get proud. And, oh, well, God had to call me first because I was one of the best ones. And then they'd have the same problem that Satan and the devil have, pride. So I'm not saying we're the best. Obviously, many of us could say in our family, there are people that had more on the ball. God should have called them in the first. But he didn't. But he does see something in each of us. He knows we can resist peer pressure. And there's something in us that he can use in this first peer pressure. And God is not wrong. So we can overcome, or God would not have chosen us. But it won't be easy. It won't be easy. Let's go to Mark 6. Now, this is Christ returning to Nazareth, his hometown. So you got to see it from what I call the hometown perspective and see if you understand what I'm saying. When the Sabbath day was come, of course, Christ always went to church on the Sabbath, as his custom was. And we should do what Christ did. And he began to teach in the synagogue. And many hearing him were astonished, saying, from whence has this man these things? In other words, they never, as far as we know, Christ did not go to any of the academies in Jerusalem to be taught by the great rabbis, the great knowledge of the Bible. So the people, this local community, says, hey, isn't that Joseph's boy who just passed away a few years ago? He's a nice young man. We like him. But where did he get these great teachings from? Where did he learn all that stuff? And who does he think he is? Anyway, from whence has man these things? And what wisdom is that which is given to him, that even such mighty works are wrought by his hands? Is not this the carpenter's son of Mary and the brother of James and Joseph and Judah and Simon? By the way, that proves that Mary had other children. She's not a perpetual virgin anyway. And are not his sisters here with us? And they were offended at him. In other words, the people in his hometown were saying, wait a minute, he's doing all these great teachings, but he's just one of us. He's just a local boy. Who does he think he is? And when you go on later, Christ says he couldn't do a lot of miracles because the prophet has no honor in his own home. I'm going to apply that to us. And say you go to your family members and you tell them that you found some new Bible truths that very few people in the world know. They're going to feel like this in their own way. They're going to say, who do you think you are? You know more than the Baptist preacher who's been studying this stuff for years? Or you know, they might have other versions of it. Who do you think you are? You know stuff that we don't know. I've been around for years. In other words, our relatives will not believe that we've been called first and that, you know, as first call would be toward the top of that pyramid that Christ is building. You know, and they might even rightfully say, well, so-and-so I always thought was a better person than you were. Why would God call you? So your relatives will not appreciate your calling, and they will try to pull you out, discourage you, and they mean well. They just can't believe that you're going to be one of the first ones to get into God's family. You know, their attitude is, so who do you think you are? But we're only here because of the grace of God. Now, I'm going to tell you a story. There was this king who didn't believe in the goodness of God. He had a very faithful servant who kept telling him all the time, everything God does is perfect. And he makes no mistakes. God makes no mistakes at all. Everything he does is perfect. Well, of course, the king didn't believe it. One day they went hunting, and out of the bushes, and apparently they didn't got too close, a wild boar charged at the king and bit his hand. And, of course, the faithful servant standing with his spear and saved the king. But the king lost a finger, you know, bloody finger, and they bandaged it up. And then when they got back in the castle, the king was mad. He said, look, I lost a finger. He said, I'm mad at God for letting me lose this bloody finger. How could that happen? You say that everything God does is good. And the servant says, yes, everything God does is good. And they get in an argument over it. And the king is so mad at losing his finger, he has the faithful servant thrown in the jail. So he goes out on another hunting trip a little bit later. And a very primitive tribe of savages attacks the king's hunting party. And all the other servants run off for their life, and they capture the king. They got him tied up, and they bring him, they get this big bundle, this big fire, and they're going to sacrifice him to one of these weird, stupid pagan gods, like human sacrifice, and oh, yeah, this would be great. And they tie him to the stake, get ready to light the fire. Then they look at his hand, and they say, hey, you're missing a finger. We can't sacrifice an imperfect, you know, person, imperfect animal. So they untie him and let him go. He runs back to the castle, and he says to the servant, well, maybe you were right. Maybe God, everything God does is good after all. I got saved because I lost a finger. Except I do have one question. Why did God let me get mad at you and put you in jail? Since you were right. And the faithful servant said, well, if I had been there, I wouldn't have run off. I would have kept fighting, we both would have been caught, and then I would have been sacrificed because I've got all my digits. And so the point of that story is God knows best. God is always right. Probably someday in the world tomorrow when we can review things and histories, we'll see the truth of that. It's probably hard to see it now. But I want to apply that to peer pressure. And I believe that God has called each of us because God knows best. He knows there's something we can contribute to God's work in the end time, and he knows that we can resist the peer pressure. You may not think you can resist it, but you can with God's help. So just remember, stay close to Christ, stay close to the church, and God believes in you. God knows we can do it. Let's go to Matthew 7. Matthew 7:13. The point I want to make is it's not going to be easy. And this is one that I remember thinking about this early in my conversion, and it made sense. Here's Christ talking. Christ says, enter you in at the straight gate. That means narrow and difficult. Like if you think about two pathways up a hillside, it's narrow and tough. The straight gate. For wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many there be that go therein. In other words, the way of this world, which basically is ungodly for the most part, is a big, wide, superhighway, and millions are going on it. But the truth is a tough, little, narrow path. We are definitely a minority and are going to stay that way. Because straight is the gate, narrow is the way that leads unto life, and few that find it. Now, God is saying few. A lot of you are going to say, well, how come we're so small and the Catholic Church has 1 billion people? I think there are 1.5 billion Muslims, and I can't remember all the other big religions, but you know, they got huge numbers. I'm almost tempted to say the more ungodly they are, the bigger the church. But maybe I shouldn't say that. But you know what I'm saying. But huge. Few there be that find it. And those few will have to resist the peer pressure that does exist. This society is deceived. So it's not going to be easy to make it. Let's go to 1 John 3. There's several things in 1 John that we want to talk about. First John 3, we'll pick it up in verse 2. Beloved, now are we the sons of God. It does not yet appear what we shall be. In other words, we're going to be changed from, we'll be seeing that in our Bible study in the next couple of weeks, from physical to spiritual. It's going to be spectacular the way Paul describes it, what we're going to be changed into. But we know that when he shall appear, meaning Christ, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. You realize that Moses couldn't actually look at God face to face in his full form because it was just too bright and powerful, would have burned him up. As it was, even with God protecting him a little bit, just watching his back, he came out glowing like somebody that got too close to like a piece of coal that got too close to a hot ember. And Moses glowed for weeks. Well, we won't be able to see Christ face to face, but we're going to be like him. Maybe a lesser glow, but we're going to be like him. That's a tremendous goal. All we can say is, wow. But if we're sucked back into the world because of peer pressure, we will miss that opportunity. Verse 4, whosoever committeth sin transgresses also the law. Now, here's a definition of sin. For sin is a transgression of the law. So law-breaking is sin. I was reading some material that somebody brought my attention to, and I saw one of the world's most clever arguments against God's law. Really clever. Let me explain how they did it. They went through those statements, or a number of them, where Christ said his law can be summarized into love God with all your heart and love mankind with all your heart, which is in the Old Testament. So he wasn't contradicting the Old. Those statements are in the Old Testament also, as we mentioned before. But they said, well, that means all you have to do is love. You don't have to keep the specifics of the law. And there are different ones that they didn't like. And, you know, different groups don't like different ones. But let me try to apply that and show you how that doesn't work. Let's say if you have a neighbor named Bob. And you say, Bob, I love you. I'm going to show you some love. But in the middle of the night when Bob's not looking, you say, well, the commandment about thou shalt not steal, well, that's a specific. As long as I love Bob, I don't have to keep specific. You steal Bob's pickup truck and take it down to the chop shop and they pay you a couple thousand. You got the money. Bob is missing a truck. Well, that's the kind of love Bob wants from his neighbors, right? Or, let's take it from God's point of view. You say, God, I love you. But when you're working and you hit your thumb with a hammer, you start screaming every epithet using God's name, of course. God's going to be happy. Well, I love God, but that's a specific about don't use his name in a vain, disrespectful way. Or the one that they all jump on is you say, God, I love you, but you show disrespect for God by nullifying the time you're supposed to spend with him on his day of worship. You say, well, it doesn't matter. We just nullify that. In other words, is God going to be happy with that? I don't think so. In other words, specifics do matter, you might say. You can say you love God, but it's the specifics or how you show you love God and how you show you love your neighbor. Don't steal your neighbor's wife or spouse, whatever. Let's go to 1 John 3, verse 7 and 8. Little children, let no man deceive you. He that doeth righteousness is righteous, even as he is righteous. He that committeth sin is of the devil. And remember, sin is breaking the law. So if you teach people, they don't need to try to obey the law. Just break all the laws you want, or at least the ones you don't like. Well, that's the devil's influence. For the devil sinneth from the beginning. For this purpose the Son of God was manifest, that he might destroy the works of the devil. In other words, Christ is coming to get rid of sin. I mean, it won't happen until Christ comes back. We probably can't imagine what a world would be like where everybody is trying to obey God. Everybody is trying to fulfill. Think about it. You wouldn't need security. You wouldn't really need locks on your doors because nobody would steal, right? And we could argue about this and that. There'd be no con men. No one would lie to you. There'd be no violence. Well, you wouldn't really need the police force, I don't believe, at least not as it is formed now. The world would be an absolute paradise, and it is coming someday. There was another study done and a survey of college students' drinking behavior. And what they found from that study was if the students believed that the norm for that campus was heavy drinking, abusing drinking, they were more likely to do that themselves. But if they were told that the norm for that campus was not to abuse drinking, they were more likely to not do it. In other words, what I call positive peer pressure. And we should try to do that positive peer pressure with each other. Encourage each other to be strong. Encourage each other to obey God. And try to set the example of courage. And that positive peer pressure will help all of us. Going over a page to 1 John 5, verse 2. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and keep His commandments. And they mean all 10 of them, of course. For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not grievous. So, you know, they're not bad. peer pressure in some areas. I mean, there'll be some positive peer pressure, but there'll be a lot of negative peer pressure when it comes to certain things of God. 1 John 5:19, over about one more page. 1 John 5:19. And we know that we are of God, and the whole world lieth in wickedness. In other words, he's saying the entire society is deceived by the devil. And if you look at Revelation 12:9, it says the entire world is deceived by the devil. And I know that's hard to believe. But if you're being rational, all these different ideas about religion and government and just all kinds of stuff is out there. They can't all be right, can they? Nope. But they can all be wrong. Think about that. They all disagree. They can't all be right. But they can all be wrong to varying degrees. And if you just read any history book and you'll read of atrocities and abuse and problems. Believe me, God could create a better world than this if this were God's world. Granted, we may live in one of the nicer places in the world, and I think that's the blessings because of Abraham and then Joseph's blessing passed on to Joseph to certain tribes of Abraham's kids. We may be enjoying the end of that. I think God is starting to take our national blessings away, and that's another story we can talk about at the Bible study. But the point I want to get at is that overall, if you're honest, God can make a better world than this. It's clear to me that this is the devil's world. And it's a society, right from the beginning, when Nimrod, who we think invented the Trinity, him, his wife, and his supposedly immaculately born son. Anyway, when Nimrod came up with the beginning of the Babylon, the great religious principles, it was made to replace and a rebellion against God. And for the most part, the world has been in rebellion against God under Satan's influence ever since. And God has allowed it until Christ gets back. And I think he's doing that to prove to mankind something. That when it's all over, people will look back and they'll review the history of the world and they'll have to say, you know, we really do need God. We can't do it on our own, and it's clear that we cannot do it on our own. I mean, it'll be as clear as a bell that people cannot do it on their own. It's just not possible. It just isn't going to work that way, and people will realize it. We just can't do it on our own. And once people realize that, I think they'll more easily get converted in the great white throne judgment, and the millennium, and we will be there to help. We'll be there to help if we remember several things. Number one, stay close to God, stay close to Christ, and ask God for help when you need it. When you feel the pressure getting strong, ask Christ for help. Number two, stay close to the church and to positive church members. You know, sometimes church members are negative, but you'll quickly know which ones are positive. Stay close to the positive church members, talk to them, and get that positive peer pressure to hold you in. And most of all, I really believe this, after I thought about this for most of the week, I believe God, obviously God knows best. If he chose you, he had a reason for choosing you. You may not know what that reason is, and maybe we won't know for a number of years, but you might make some great witness near the end. You just never know. Or you might provide a vital support for God's church during key years, or maybe all of the above. Who knows what your future is? And maybe the things you've learned, maybe both the hard way and the easy way, will be helpful to the people in the world tomorrow. But also, he knows that you can withstand the peer pressure, or he wouldn't have called you. Because why call somebody for guaranteed failure? So remember, God knows best. Ask God for help. Stay close to the positive members of the church. And know that God knows that you can make it.